Well, today, as I look around, many of you had the early and medieval church. So we are kind of picking up the story where we left off. And I will go over the syllabus with you next time. I have to update that still. The information is still correct as far as assignments and so forth, but I have to change the dates on the syllabus that you'll find on Moodle. But I will get that up shortly. But today, I would just like to begin by talking to you about the decline of the Roman Catholic Church and talking about some areas that reform was definitely needed. Even before we get up to Martin Luther, who I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with, there were some attempts to reform the Catholic Church. Some would try to bring the same sorts of reforms that Martin Luther will attempt to bring. Others were just trying to improve the Roman Catholic Church in other ways, not just not in theological ways necessarily, but it was seen that they were a struggling organization that definitely needed reform. So to begin talking about the decline of the Roman Catholic Church and why it needed reform, it's important to point out that the Roman Catholic Church was at the height of its power during the period of the Crusades. The Roman Catholic Church in Western Europe and even in parts of Eastern Europe was the unquestioned church. Western Christianity was still almost entirely under the leadership of the Catholic Church. This was not only true in the sense that they were the only church in Western Europe for the most part. Of course, there's the Eastern Orthodox Church, mostly in Eastern Europe and other parts of the East, but also the way people thought about themselves, the ways they thought about the church. It was the unquestioned church, and no one wanted another church. The medieval people felt that there should only be one physical church, and that being the Roman Catholic Church. And this had long been the opinion of people in Western Europe. Indeed, Saint Cyprian, speaking in the 3rd century, said a very famous statement. He said, "No one can have God for his father who does not have the church for his mother." No one can have God for his father who does not have the church for his mother. Now, that said, that quote I think is true today, but the way that they interpreted that quote in medieval times was when you said the church as your mother, they felt you meant specifically the Roman Catholic Church. Yet from about the year 1300 all the way up to Martin Luther in the year 1517, the church's power began to decline. And it would decline for various reasons. And you see those up on the PowerPoint here. The first reason that it started to decline was because of failures of the clergy. And these failures of clergy would lead to a loss of esteem by the people for, you know, your pastors, for your bishops, even for the Pope himself. Queen Elizabeth of Castile, in about the year 1500, said the following: "The dissolution is such that the souls entrusted to the clergy receive great damage. For we are told that the majority of the clergy are living in open concubinage, and that if our justice intervenes to punish them, they revolt and create a scandal, and that they despise our justice, and to the point they are themselves against it." So they were not living lives of celibacy. Since 1139, the Roman Catholic Church made it official that if you were to be a priest, a bishop, pope, monk, nun, you had to be celibate. And you were not allowed to marry or in any other way have a partner in life in that sense. Yet while celibacy of priests was the official stance of the church, many priests not only lived in open concubinage, but did not attempt to hide the fact. As a matter of fact, there are stories of priests going to do the mass with their children with them and their, you know, as they sometimes termed it, spiritual sister. And well, you all are a member of a church. You know how churches are. Even if you don't have something that open, rumors spread. And these weren't even rumors. These were facts. They knew what was going on here. This would just be seem strange to you as a church member that your priest, as well, a woman he is not married to because he couldn't marry her, but also children. Some in the congregation, it should be pointed out, did not oppose this completely. Some of them felt that it was wrong that priests were not allowed to marry. So there might be some sympathy for the priest, but still, this does not quite square well, correct? I mean, here's your priest who says he will be celibate, but is not. This is not good to be seeing in your church every week, if this is the rule. There were also issues related to priests, believe it or not, hiring prostitutes. In a German bar, it was sometimes said as an insult to a woman, "Go hang out with the priests and monks as you have surely done before." What's more, there were hardly, so that was one reason that there was a decline in respect, prestige for the clergy, the hierarchy of the church. This issue that celibacy was the rule, but it was not always followed. And as Queen Isabella had stated, she said the majority of priests did this. We don't know. There's no way to prove that, but apparently it was widespread. Also, what's more, there were hardly any real educational requirements to be a priest. There were not any particularly official requirements to be a priest. Now, there were many who were highly educated. It was preferred that you went to school, and many did, but it was not required, and there were many who did not have the training that they should have possessed. And I think you see what the problem is here. I mean, how can someone tell you, and this is very important, especially in the Middle Ages to many, many people, the way to salvation. How could they tell you the way to salvation if they have not really studied the scriptures, have not really studied what it is that the church teaches, have not studied how to lead worship, and so forth? This is an obvious issue that was a problem at this time for the clergy. Monastic orders were also in decline. I mean, if you wanted to be a monk in the old sense of the word, or a nun living in a monastery, you are going there to be a spiritual warrior, right? You are going there to, walk, live out the Sermon on the Mount, to pray, 8 hours a day, to give every moment of your life, to do the Latin phrase, ora e labora, prayer and work. Well, while that was the ideal, at this time things had declined so much that basically monks were accused of basically being lazy. I read this morning having a cat, that a cat, if they live to be 12 years old, will sleep 8 years of their life. So maybe more cat-like than they should have been. So they had fallen into these, houses, very lazy in their disciplines, their spiritual disciplines. They were not there for the right reasons, to be these spiritual warriors, if you will, trying to grow into the image of Christ. That was another reason. Also, issues related to clergy were difficult to address because many bishops and priests had attained their positions through simony. And I defined what simony was in the last class we had, but I'll do it again. Simony was the practice of buying and selling church offices. Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8, verses 9 through 24, tries to purchase the Holy Spirit. And of course, this was seen as, absolutely wrong. Well, many priests, many bishops, and even the popes would purchase their positions in the church. And this is bad if you're trying to fight corruption, because this is obviously not how things are supposed to be. And so basically, your first act to get into your job is to basically bribe officials to get you that job. This is not a good group to be doing your reform with. Now, I think that it is important to say that I do not want to overstate the problem either. There were good monks. There were good nuns, there were good priests, and so on. But there were enough of, the bad out there that there were serious issues within the church. Lack of education, lack of living the morality that they claimed, and issues of bribery. There is also, secondly, what is known as the Babylonian captivity of the church. The Babylonian captivity of the church. And this would last from 1309 to 1377. So what happened was, in the year 1305, there was a Frenchman who would take the name Clement the Fifth. And what he would do is he would take the papal throne. And he was considered basically a very weak ruler. And the French king, who was at that time, you know, a very powerful king in Europe, convinced Clement V to move the papal seat, the capital of the papacy, from Rome to Avignon. Now, at this time, Avignon was not completely a part of France, but it was heavily influenced by France. Well, this began the Babylonian captivity, or some call it the Avignon papacy. I think that's what the Estonian was saying there. There would be seven successors, seven people who would follow Clement V, and all of them would be French, and all of them would rule from Avignon. And there were many who really did not like this. After all, the English at this time had a famous rivalry. I mean, actually the French and English for many centuries were enemies, and they despised this. The English and others would say that the Pope had just basically become a puppet of the French king, and there is evidence that they were not wrong. This was not a good situation for many other nations. Well, how did this come to an end? Actually, a very famous mystic by the name of Catherine of Siena convinced Pope Gregory the 11th that he should return the papacy to Rome. And in 1377, shortly before Gregory the 11th's death, he returned it to Rome. And this ended this Babylonian captivity. This period once again weakened the prestige and weakened the influence of the papacy and also the Roman Catholic Church. However, it was over. So you think things are going to get better, right? I mean, the Pope is back in Rome. Everything is as it should be. Well, the Italians want to make sure this is how it's going to remain. So when they're basically, after Gregory's death, he just died a few months after moving it back, with the cardinals gathered to elect another pope. And the people of Rome, outside where they were gathering to elect the new pope, rioted. And they were making all sorts of noise, all sorts of threats. And under this kind of pressure, the cardinals elected an Italian pope. So they got what they wanted. They didn't want to see someone go off to France again. The pope was theirs. I mean, Saint Peter died in Rome, don't you know? That means you must have the papacy here. They elected a guy by the name of Urban the Sixth. And Urban the Sixth, as you may know, is, well, I mean, basically that means that Urban the Sixth is the boss of these cardinals now who elected him. And it turns out that Urban the Sixth is the kind of boss you do not want. He's just a nasty guy, very demanding and hard to work with. The cardinals do not like him. So they determine that they will reconvene and they reconvened in another part of Italy. And you know what they did? With no mob there, they decided to elect a second pope. This is unheard of. They basically say the first one, that was no good. We're electing a new guy. You know, fire the old guy, elect this new guy. And this new guy took the name Clement the VII. And as you can imagine, this caused extreme issues. I think, who's the real pope? I guess maybe an equivalent, when I think about the process here, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean the parliament in Estonia elects the president of Estonia. Imagine if they elected, the president, and they said, we really don't like him. Let's elect another one. I mean, you know, this is very odd, very strange. The difference here, of course, is that, there are term limits on the president here, but the pope is kind of for life. So who's the real pope? The same people have elected two popes. And this would divide Europe. Urban VI, the Italian guy, would be the favorite of northern Italy, most of what is modern Germany, Scandinavia, and England. The other would be Clement VII would be favored by France, Spain, Scotland, and southern Italy. And lo and behold, Clement VII decides that he does not want to live in Italy, but guess where? Avignon. So once again, we have the same issue. Think it's over? No, we're back to Avignon. It's in southern France now. I mean, that's supposedly a really nice place. Maybe it was nice back then as well. This issue would not be resolved until a series of reforming councils, which brought the crises to an end in 1417. But as you can imagine, once again, this really hurt the papacy's prestige. The next issue that would be a problem for people is growing dislike of paying taxes to the Pope. It's interesting. Two summers ago, my oldest son, Carl, got the age of 12 to do like a work program through the local area. They let them work like for 2 weeks, I think about 20 hours a week. And they paid them, and he got his first paycheck. And he saw, he was told how much he made an hour, and he's like, wait a minute, that doesn't work out to what I'm getting in this, in my bank account. And we explained to him the idea of taxes. And he's very conservative on this issue. He was outraged, and he asked, where does that money go? And I explained roads and police. And he was like, why do we need to pay? Come on, roads can't cost that much. He did not like this idea of taxes. And I really don't think I have met anybody who really likes paying taxes. May understand it, but the word like does not come into it. And as you can imagine, this really is not that hard to get your mind around. Wait a minute. I'm German. I speak German. I live in German states. Why am I paying this guy thousands of kilometers away that I'll never see all that money? And this is just something that kicked around. And they really did not like it in much of Europe. In Rome, you might have liked it because you get all these wonderful buildings built and all of that. But it really did not sit well with many people in Europe. And there were significant taxes to be paid to the Pope and to the church. For instance, there was a tax called the Anates. And what this was if you were a church official, priest, bishop, and all the rest, you were expected to pay your first year's salary to the Pope. That's right. Your first year's salary went to the Pope. Once again, talking about simony. There is also something called the right of purveyance. What that meant is, I mean, I think it was what, 2 or 3 years ago, Pope Francis came to Estonia, came to Tallinn. The rule back then was if you had the blessing of the Pope travel through your lands, you were expected to pay every expense the Pope had while visiting your territory. So you had to pay for whatever his horses ate, whatever his personal, guards ate, his small army that he brought with him, his servants, whatever. And you had to put them up, of course, house them somehow. All of that you would have to pay for. And another tax, there was what was called the right of spoil, where the property of the upper clergy, bishops and cardinals, went to the Pope upon their death. So if you were a cardinal, everything you possessed went to the Pope when you passed away. There also were expected tithes of the people and kings. And England, when the Pope was in Avignon, really despised having to pay money to the Pope when they felt he was an enemy, when they felt he was a tool used by their enemy, the French king. Fifth, there was the rise of nation states. The rise of nation states. With the rise of nationalism came the rise of nation states. And this started to break apart the idea of the Holy Roman Empire and the Holy Catholic Church's idea of a united empire and a united church. If you recall from your last class, the medieval world's perfect model was that you had everything united together. They liked unity. They liked having one pope and one church. They liked the idea of having one united empire, that being the Holy Roman Empire at the time. Yet at this time, people weren't as interested in unity in all things. They started to have national identities. And these national identities were starting to replace the idea of this view of the ideal world. And So people started to focus more on not what kept them together united, but what kind of made them, well, for lack of a better term, special. What united me with people that I live near or around? The idea that, hey, I speak this language, I speak French. Therefore, I associate with French-speaking people. And also, some of these kingdoms, these smaller parts of the Holy Roman Empire and such, started to have power of their own because they also were starting to grow in wealth in their local areas. So these different language groups, these different ethnicities started to realize, hey, we're a little bit different. We want our own grouping of people compared to being just part of this big empire. And when these nation states saw corruption in the church, and not owing as much loyalty to the church as they did in the past, they demanded reform. And when reform didn't come from Rome, it led to a breaking away from Rome in the 16th century by the Protestants. So failures of the clergy, this Babylonian captivity, this great Western schism, papal taxation, and rise of nation states were all reasons for this breaking down of the empire.